is on path of stronger, equitable and sustainable growth. The global easing of monetary policy, whilst essential for the recovery, should be complemented with measures to prevent build-up of financial risk over the medium term, and central bank independence should be safeguarded at all costs. Needed fiscal spending and the output collapse have driven global sovereign debt levels to a record 100% of global GDP or gross domestic product. Whilst low interest rates alongside the projected rebound in economic growth in 2021 will stabilize debt levels in many countries, all will benefit from a medium-term fiscal framework to give confidence that debt remains sustainable. In the future, governments will likely need to raise the progressivity of their taxes, whilst ensuring that corporations pay their fair share of taxes, alongside eliminating wasteful spending. Investments in the health sector, digital infrastructure, green infrastructure, and education can help achieve productive, inclusive, and sustainable economic growth. And expanding the safety net where gaps exist can ensure the most vulnerable are protected while supporting near-term activity. This is the worst crisis since the Great Depression of the 1930s, and it will take significant innovation on the policy front at both the national and international levels to recover from this calamity. The challenges are daunting, but there are reasons to be hopeful. The exceptional policy response, including the establishment of the European Union Pandemic Recovery Package Fund and the use of digital technologies to deliver social assistance, are a powerful reminder that the well-designed policies protect people and collective economic well-being. At the International Monetary Fund, IMF, we have provided funding at record speed to 81 member states since the start of the coronavirus pandemic, granted debt relief, and called for expanded debt service suspension for low-income countries and for reform of the international debt architecture. Building on these actions, policies for the next stage of the crisis must seek lasting improvements in the global economy that create prosperous futures for all of us.
This is for a better life. For a better life.
فرمود بعثت لأتمم مكارم الأخلاق.
The Holy Prophet of Islam says, I have been sent to complete noble manners.
In the name of the one who loves us more than we love him, in the name of Allah, the subtle, the most generous. Dear brothers and sisters, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and welcome to another program for a better life here on IRIB English Radio. I'm your host, Sayyid Wahid Alawi. In the previous program, I talked about lowering our expectations as scholars and non-scholars, and we should not expect people to serve us, we should serve mankind, as the example of the noble prophet and all prophets prior to him, and the example of the imams alayhim assalam. So we should greet people. Just like the prophet said, there are three things that I would not leave as long as I am alive. What are those three things? One of them is greeting the people before they greet me. So the prophets used to greet people before they actually could greet him. He would say assalamu alaikum even to the children prior to them being able to answer back. So no one would have superiority of the prophet in saying salam, the peace greeting, than the prophet himself. He would say salam first. The second and third things are sitting on the ground and not walking in front of others. The prophet was so humble that he used to not walk in front of others. Lust and anger must be in accordance to one's intellect and divine decree. What do I mean with that? We said that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, with His perfect wisdom, gave man two powers. What were those two powers? Lust and anger. If these two powers are in balance with the third power, which is the intellect, man will be successful. He will achieve bliss and felicity in this world and the next world. Man will reach perfection if these two powers are used in the middle course, the course accepted by both the intellect and the divine decrees given to us by the prophets. Man will fall if he acts in excess. He will leave the human world and enter the animal world. According to the Quran, he will be even lower than the animals. What about physical and spiritual benefits found in food? Let's talk about that a little bit. Eating is a very important dimension in human life. And if a religion does not talk about food ethics, then that religion should not be taken seriously. We know that Musa alayhi salam followed food ethics. We know that Isa al-Masih alayhi salam followed a specific food ethics. Even though Christians today do not follow it, Isa al-Masih followed it according to the Torah and the Bible. And so does Islam. Islam has food ethics, rules for it. It has rules for it. And one of them is that eating too little is when all of the necessary food products do not reach one's body. A person who eats too little does not benefit from the good things that Allah created for him. Thus, Islam recommends us to eat to a certain level where we are full, but not completely full. And we should not eat when we are full, because that would give us diseases. A person who eats too little does not benefit from the good things that Allah created for him.
We were given so many prizes. We changed the desert into oases. We built buildings of different lengths and sizes. And we felt so very satisfied. We bought and bought and couldn't stop buying. We gave charity to the poor cause we couldn't stand the crying. We thought we paid our dues, but in fact, to ourselves we're just lying. Oh, I'm walking with my head lowered in shame for my place. I'm walking with my head lowered for my race. Yes, it's easy to blame everything on the West, when in fact our focus should be on ourselves. I'm walking with my head lowered in shame for my place. I'm walking with my head lowered for my race. Yes, it's easy to blame everything on the West, when in fact our focus should be on ourselves. Is it satisfied? Is Allah satisfied? Is Allah satisfied?
One must benefit from food both materially and spiritually. When one eats halal food provided with halal money, that is something that we usually forget. We have in the West, for example, Muslims who work in shops that I cannot even mention here on the radio. And on Fridays, they go to Salatul Jum'ah. There, all those immoral shops are closed. We have Muslims who work in bars. They are bartenders. They are even, na'udhu billah, may Allah protect us, they are even owners of those bars with alcoholic beverages. And on Fridays, they close down the bars and go. That is the best scenario, that they close down the bars on a Friday and go for Salatul Jum'ah. Or they continue working and they do not even think about closing or going to a Friday Jum'ah. they continue working, and with that haram money, they go and buy halal food. They go and buy halal meat. Brothers and sisters, that is not acceptable. Those kind of employments, those kind of occupations, those kind of jobs are not acceptable. We have to change our job, make a tawbah, repent to Allah, and earn halal money. Only then, and only then, are we able to eat halal food. That is called halal food, when we earn the money from halal ways. And when one eats halal food, it will both strengthen his body and strengthen his soul. What I mean with halal food could also be organic food, where you have treated that animal with kindness. That animal has been an animal, has lived as an animal, has had its spacious place. A cow is actually living as a cow. A cow has its spacious place to move, to go around. A chicken, for example, has its spacious place. It's not living in a cage, an A4 cage, with other chickens. That is not humane. That is inhuman behavior to those animals. And that meat will affect us and affect our souls. So try to eat organic food, which is halal organic. And that will strengthen our body and strengthen our soul. The reason for this is that there is a little bit of Allah's perfection in the food. Man must eat sweet fruit and pay attention to who created the fruit. He should think about the power and wisdom. He must have had to make these fruits from water and dirt. He should thank Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and increase his love of him. One should benefit from the delicious food that Allah has made. So one has lost both physically and spiritually if he or she does not benefit from food. So till next time, dear brothers and sisters, think about this aspect. Eat halal food earned from halal money and try to make it organic, even if it is a little bit more expensive, but that will suit you at the end of the day, because you will not poison your body with unhealthy meat or food. Till next time, may Allah's peace and blessings be upon all of you.
Your mercy, your love is all I need.
Your love is all I need.
All I need.
Your love is all I need.
That's all I need.
Your love is all I need.
All I need.
Your love is all I need.
Oh, 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 oh.
Cause your love is all I need. To be all I need. And I know that you see how much you need. You need to me, 'cause your love is all I need. To be all I can be, and I know that you see how much you mean to me.
Your love is all I need.
In the limelight.
According to NASA estimates, there are at least 100 billion stars in the Milky Way galaxy, of which about 4 billion are sun-like. If only 7% of those stars have habitable planets, a seriously conservative estimate, there could be as many as 300 million potentially habitable Earth-like planets out there in the whole Milky Way alone. Ravi Kumar Kaparapu, a researcher at NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center in Greenbelt, Maryland, said, "We want to be very conservative in case nature has any surprises regarding habitability." He added, "So we are lowballing the estimates intentionally. On average, the astronomers calculated the nearest such planet should be about 20 light-years away, and there should be four of them within 30 light years or so of the sun. We are prepared for you an article written by Dennis Overby, titled Looking for Another Earth, Here Are 300 Million, Maybe. The article has appeared in the New York Times. Please stay with us for more of Dennis Overby's article. A decade ago, a band of astronomers set out to investigate one of the oldest questions taunting philosophers, scientists, priests, astronomers, mystics, and the rest of the human race. How many more Earths are out there, if any? How many far-flung planets exist that could harbor life as we know it? Their tool was the Kepler spacecraft, which was launched in March of 2009 on a 3.5-year mission to monitor 150,000 stars in a patch of sky in the Milky Way. It looked for tiny dips in starlight caused by an exoplanet passing in front of its home star. When the mission was launched in March of 2009, William Borucki said, "It's not ET, but it's ET home." It was Borucki, an astronomer now retired from NASA's Ames Research Center, who dreamed up of the project and spent two decades convincing NASA to do it. Before the spacecraft finally gave out in 2018, it had discovered more than 4,000 candidate worlds among those stars. So far, none have shown any sign of life or habitation. Granted, they're very far away and hard to study. Extrapolated, that figure suggests that there are billions of exoplanets in the Milky Way galaxy. But how many of those are potentially habitable? After crunching Kepler's data for 2 years, a team of 44 astronomers led by Steve Bryson of NASA Ames Research Center has landed on what they say is the definitive answer, at least for now. Their paper has been accepted for publication in the Astronomical Journal. Kepler's formal goal was to measure a number called Eta Earth, the fraction of sun-like stars that have an Earth-sized object orbiting them in the Goldilocks or habitable zone, where it is warm enough for the surface to retain liquid water. The team calculated that at least one-third, and perhaps as many as 90% of stars similar in mass and brightness to our own sun have rocks like Earth in their habitable zones, with a range reflecting the researchers' confidence in their various methods and assumptions. That is no small bonanza, however you look at it. According to NASA estimates, there are at least 100 billion stars in the Milky Way galaxy, of which about 4 billion are sun-like. If only 7% of those stars have habitable planets, a seriously conservative estimate, there could be as many as 300 million potentially habitable Earth-like planets out there in the whole Milky Way galaxy alone. Ravi Kumar Kaparapu, a researcher at NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center in Greenbelt, Maryland, and one of the authors of the report, said, "We want to be very conservative in case nature has any surprises regarding habitability," he added, "so we are lowballing the estimates intentionally. On average, astronomers calculated the nearest such planet should be about 20 light years away, and there should be four of them within 30 light years or so of our own sun. Natalie Batalha, an astronomer at the University of California at Santa Cruz, who directed the Kepler mission during most of its life and was one of the authors of the new paper, in a triumphant email said, "It took 11 years from launch to publication, but this is it. She added, this is the science result we've all been waiting for, the reason that Kepler was selected for flight in December of 2001. The new result means that the galaxy is at least twice as fertile as estimated in one of the first analyses of Kepler data in 2013. That finding by Andrew Howard, Eric Petigura, and Jeffrey Marcy, who were not part of the Kepler team, concluded that about one-fifth of sun-like stars harbored planets in their habitable zones. Natalie Batalha said that one improvement this time around was the addition of data from the European Gaia satellite, which has measured the position and brightness of 1 billion stars. The knowledge allowed the Kepler scientists to more precisely chart the habitable zones of their stars. Another improvement was better handling of the statistics, although, as Natalie Batalha noted, surveys are inherently incomplete. You can't call up every citizen. You can't observe every star. In the case of Kepler, the limitation was serious. The spacecraft's orientation system failed before Kepler could complete the primary survey, which limited it to detecting planets that had orbital periods of less than about 700 days, about twice the duration of an Earth year. In an email, David Charbonneau, the Harvard Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics, said he was slightly skeptical of the result. The Kepler mission didn't detect many, arguably any, true Earth analogs, that is, planets with the same radius as Earth and orbiting at the same period, and hence receiving the same amount of light, and orbiting sun-like stars. As Natalie Batalha said at the time, we don't yet have any planet candidates that are exact analogs of the Earth in terms of size, orbit, and star type. We still don't. As a result, the astronomers had to extrapolate data from the planets that they did see. Although these Kepler planets are Earth size, 1.5 the radius of Earth, they are presumably rocky. Nobody knows what they are like in any detail, nor whether anything does or could live on them. They are too far away for further study. So far, we know of only one planet, our own, that harbors life. But there are plenty of opportunities yet to find out. The Kepler measurement of Eta Earth only pertains to stars like the Sun, but in the galaxy those stars are vastly outnumbered by smaller, dimmer stars known as red dwarfs. 1/4 to 1/2 of red dwarfs also harbor habitable zone planets, according to work by Courtney Dressing, now at the University of California at Berkeley, although some astronomers worry that radiation flares from such stars would doom any life trying to get started there. Red dwarf planets were not included in the new analysis of Eta Earth. The red dwarf planets are relevant to the search for life because Kepler has passed the torch to a spacecraft called the Transiting Exoplanet Survey Satellite, or TESS, which was launched in 2018 to scour the entire sky for exoplanets within a few hundred light-years of Earth, the local neighborhood. So far, TESS, or the Transiting Exoplanet Survey Satellite, has discovered 66 new exoplanets and has cataloged more than 2,000 candidates. George Ricker, an astrophysicist at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, MIT, and principal investigator for the mission, in an email said, most of those planets were expected to be found circling red dwarfs. He added, since about 3/4 of the stars in the solar neighborhood are M dwarfs, that leaves open a very large discovery space for TESS in the decade ahead. Natalie Batalha said that young scientists in the future might yet find a way to improve the value of Eta Earth. Until then, this will be the de facto standard. The value of Eta Earth is an important and hitherto unknown factor in a mathematical expression known as the Drake equation. It is used by astronomers to estimate how many technological civilizations might exist in the galaxy, and that we might be able to contact by radio or other means some cosmic day. It's time to move on to the next factor in the Drake equation for extraterrestrial civilizations, the fraction of these worlds on which life emerges. The search for even a single slime mold on some alien rock would revolutionize biology, and it is a worthy agenda for the next half century as humans continue to climb out of ourselves and into the universe in the endless quest to end our cosmic loneliness.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
This is A to Z. An introduction to Islamic lifestyle. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Most Beneficent, the Most Merciful. Dear brothers and sisters, Assalamu alaikum. Peace and blessings of Allah be upon you all. This is A to Z, coming to you from IRIB English Radio, and I'm your host, Ali. This radio show is about Islamic lifestyle, and in each episode, we will be talking about a different lesson. Please stay with us till the end of today's program. Today's lesson, what breaks a person's back? Today we're going to discuss three types of people. These people are the ones who take the loss. Well, the first category is those who magnify their deeds, they will sit back. Well satisfied with their work, their attitude hinders them from progress and development. The second type of people are those who forget their sins will continue with new sins every day instead of compensating for their previous sins. Suddenly, one day, they will find themselves down in depths of despair. The third category is people who rely on their own opinion. It will deprive themselves of valuable and essential knowledge and thinking of brilliant minds. They will be repeatedly involved in mistakes, and finally, their backs will break under the burden of the resulting problems. So these are the three categories which we see take the loss. They take the detriment, and they're the ones who actually bear so many difficulties in their lives, but they don't learn the lesson. So we're discussing these three types today. So the first one is those who magnify their deeds. The second one is those who forget their sins. And then the third one is people who are opinionated in a way that they do not listen to anyone else's opinion. They don't take input. They're just, you know, my way or highway type of people. These three types, in the light of Quranic verses and the traditions of Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam, are the ones who take the loss in this life. Welcome back, dear listeners. Today we are discussing about three groups of people who take the loss. They are the one who have to face detrimental results of their approach that they have taken in their lives. Imam Baqir alayhi salam, the fifth infallible Imam, says, the three types of individuals who destroy themselves. Number one, the one who magnifies his good deeds. Number two, the one who forgets his sins. Number three, the one who is opinionated. Brothers and sisters, magnifying one's good deeds is really, really unhealthy, and this is something that destroys one's spirituality. This is something that actually destroys that good deed itself, the reward of that good deed, because they are magnifying their good deed. Something good that they have done in their lives, they want everybody else, everybody around them to know about it. And this is something which is not appreciated in Islam. Those who forget about their own sins, you know, just you can well imagine these self-righteous people, you know, they think that they have not done anything wrong and everybody around them is some sort of a sinner, but they are so clean, so pious. You know, these are again the people who forget about their own mistakes, their shortcomings, their sins. They are the ones who destroy themselves in the light of the hadith of Imam Baqir alayhi salam. Last but not the least, people who are opinionated. You know, they just take this high-end approach and they're always like, my way or the highway. You know, whatever I'm saying is right and nobody else has any opinion whatsoever. And even if somebody is expressing their opinion in front of them, they give them a shut-up call. So these are the three types of people who actually destroy themselves in this life and unfortunately in many cases in the hereafter. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, thank you very much for staying with us till the end of today's episode of A to Z. Don't forget to log on to our website at www.parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We leave you all in the care of Allah. Till next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
In the limelight.
New data shows growth slowing down in Britain's dominant service sector. Last month, the British economy is headed for a double-dip recession this winter. According to the latest IHS Market KIPS monthly survey of the services sector, which is equal to three-quarters of economic activity, a recovery over the summer stalled in October, increasing additional pressure on the Bank of England to improve the stimulus program when officials met on Thursday, 5th of November. The Bank of England's Monetary Policy Committee's meeting considered a big injection of funds to support the economy. Whilst this was regarded as an unlikely prospect only a few weeks ago, most city analysts have projected a £100 billion rise in quantitative easing, where the bank injects money into the economy by acquiring government debt from financial institutions. IHS Market said several months of declining consumer confidence, which has tracked the increase in the number of coronavirus cases, decreased demand for hotels and restaurants, whilst the government's policy of tiered lockdowns effectively stopped the return to the office across much of the country. We now present you an article written jointly by staff writers of the British daily The Guardian and Iran's English language TV channel Press TV under the heading UK MPs vote for second coronavirus lockdown as its economy heading for double dip recession. Please stay with us. British MPs have resoundingly voted to support Prime Minister Boris Johnson's plan for a month-long lockdown, which began on Thursday, 5th of November. The government kept a rebellion by recalcitrant Conservative MPs at the House of Commons at bay to win by a staggering 516 votes to 38, a majority of 478. The vote means that as of Thursday, 5th of November, hotels, coffee shops, restaurants and non-essential shops have closed across England and stay shut until 2nd of December. People also were told to stay at home apart from when attending school, college, university, work, or to go shopping for food and essentials. The latest lockdown effectively replaces the three-tier system of regional restrictions across England for 4 weeks, after which the tiers will be reimposed. Before the vote, the Prime Minister, Boris Johnson, counselled MPs that a second lockdown was required to contain the surge of COVID-19 cases. Boris Johnson warned in dramatic style that absent immediate action, Britain could expect deaths on a grievous scale, with hospitals in extraordinary trouble as early as next month. During a three-hour debate in the House of Commons, Tory rebels, in addition to a handful of Labour MPs from northwest of England, tried to push back against the Prime Minister's plan, largely on economic and personal liberty grounds. Sir Graham Brady, the chair of the powerful 1922 Committee of Tory backbenchers, told the House he would vote against the lockdown with greater conviction than any other vote he has cast in his 23 years in Parliament. Brady claimed, "The thing that troubles me most is that the government is reaching too far into the private and family lives of our constituents." Former Prime Minister Theresa May opposed Boris Johnson's plan on the grounds that COVID-19 cases in Liverpool, a hotspot for coronavirus infections, is supposedly falling. Theresa May's position was supported by former Tory leader Ian Duncan Smith, who questioned the data behind the Prime Minister's proposed second lockdown. Duncan Smith was also critical of the appalling leak of the government's lockdown plan to the media before its official announcement. But despite the vociferous opposition from senior Conservatives, Boris Johnson remained resolute in the House, proclaiming that he's not prepared to take the risk with the lives of British people. The vote in the House of Commons took place on the day that a further 25,177 people tested positive for COVID-19 in the United Kingdom, accompanied by 492 confirmed coronavirus-related deaths. Meanwhile, the leader of the opposition Labour Party, Keir Starmer, has launched a stinging attack on the Chancellor of the Exchequer, Rishi Sunak, accusing him of underestimating the economic impact of the COVID-19 pandemic. Speaking at the Confederation of British Industry CBI conference on Monday, 2nd of November, Keir Starmer directly blamed Rishi Sunak for the severe economic cost of the late lockdown. Starmer proclaimed, "Make no mistake, the Chancellor's blame is all over this." The Labour leader added, Rishi Sunak's decision to block a circuit breaker lockdown, to dismiss it as a blunt instrument and to pretend that you can protect the economy without controlling the virus, will now mean that businesses have to close for longer, more people will lose their jobs, and the public finances will be worse than they need to be. Keir Starmer urged the Chancellor to set out a full package of support in keeping with what was offered during the first lockdown in spring, to ease the pain of shutting down the bulk of the economy. The Labour leader also used the occasion to address wider issues relating to the lockdown, including the protection of the country's core infrastructure. According to Labour leader Starmer, the four-week lockdown must be used to fix, test, trace and isolate, and to give control to local authorities, to get a grip on messaging and rebuild public trust, and to provide a clear and transparent roadmap to protect businesses and the NHS over the months to come. Starmer's stinging attack on the Chancellor and the government was all the more striking as Prime Minister Boris Johnson dropped out of speaking at the same event. Instead, Business Secretary Alok Sharma addressed the CBI conference and admitted that a full functioning vaccine may never materialize. Moreover, according to data that shows growth slowing down in Britain's dominant services sector last month, Britain's economy is headed for a double dip recession this winter. According to the latest IHS Market SIPS monthly survey of the services sector, which is equal to three quarters of the economic activity, a recovery over the summer stalled in October increased additional pressure on the Bank of England to improve its stimulus program when officials met on Thursday, 5th of November. The Bank of England's Monetary Policy Committee's meeting considered a big injection of funds to support the economy. Whilst this was regarded as unlikely prospect only a few weeks ago, most city analysts now have projected a £100 billion rise in quantitative easing, where the bank injects money into the economy by acquiring government debt from financial institutions. IHS Markets said several months of declining consumer confidence, which has tracked the increase in the number of coronavirus cases, decreased demand for hotels and restaurants, whilst the government's policy of tiered lockdowns effectively stopped a return to the office across much of England. The Purchasing Managers Index, PMI, for the services sector, which includes industries ranging from retail to hospitality and financial services, fell to 51.4 in October, from 56.1 in the previous month, September, to come in below the consensus reach among city analysts and an earlier flash estimate of 52.3. The composite Purchasing Managers Index, PMI, which encompasses the manufacturing sector, dropped to 52.1 from 56.5 in September. IHS Economics Director Tim Moore said the data collected between 12 and 28th of October, before the second nationwide lockdown was imposed, showed the economy seemed on course for a double-dip recession this winter and a far more challenging path to economic recovery in 2021. Two successive quarters of negative growth, which happened in the first 6 months of 2020, equates to a recession, with the term double dip, which is used to describe two downturns in quick succession. The Purchasing Managers Index report said employment across the services sector decreased for the eighth consecutive month, whereas customer-facing service providers, especially those in hotels and restaurants and catering establishments, faced a slump. New orders declined for the first time since June. Tim Moore said, a lack of forward bookings in parts of the economy most affected by lockdown measures led to widespread reports of redundancies and another sharp fall in total employment numbers during October. Samuel Toombs, the chief UK economist at Pantheon Macroeconomics, said market surveys suggest the recovery essentially ground to a halt in October. He said the effect will be disclosed in lower gross domestic product growth, which would stay around 8% below its pre-COVID peak at the end of the year. Samuel Toombs said October was a turning point on several fronts, asserting that a dramatic fall in the use of public and private transport and a drop in demand for discretionary consumer services contributed to a wider slowdown. Samuel Toombs noted, "The second wave of COVID-19 is the obvious driver of the slowdown, though the recovery likely would have decelerated anyway, given that pent-up demand after the first lockdown ended temporarily pushed activity in the consumer services sector above its sustainable level over the summer." Meanwhile, Howard Archer, the chief economic advisor to the EI Item Club, said, "There seems little doubt that a renewed national lockdown will cause the economy to contract again in the fourth quarter of this year, and very possibly by an appreciable amount." The EY Item Club's initial projection is that there might be a gross domestic product contraction of between 5 to 8% in the fourth quarter of this year. Archer said the uncertainty over the Brexit negotiations between the United Kingdom and the European Union, noting even before a new national lockdown in England, as well as varying measures announced so far in Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland, the fourth quarter was looking much more challenging for Britain's economy, and it was likely there would be a marked rise in unemployment as the furlough scheme drew to a close in October, even allowing for the government's latest, more generous job support measures. Archer added, "On top of that, business caution has been added to by uncertainties over whether Britain and the European Union will reach a trade agreement by 31st of December."
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Around the World with Reporters.
With the name of Martyr Qasim Soleimani decorating the Persian Language Department at the University of Sana'a, the first graduates of the department walking down it, reviving the memory of Hajj Qasim, who they carried his name as a title for their badge.
When we talked about the Persian language, it was impossible to learn it because of the international fight against it, and whoever spoke it was considered as the enemy of Islam. Today, however, we have proved to the world that we and the Iranian people are brothers, and Islam unites us.
Graduates expressed their overwhelming joy of this accomplishment, stressing that their choice name for the Soleimani badge comes at a critical time in light of American unilateralism, reaching its peak.
Tadhaf Fihad Martyr Soleimani's efforts in the region and his support for the Palestinian cause requires us to revive his memory by naming a badge in his name.
The ceremony came after Hassan Erlu presented his credentials to the President of the Supreme Political Council, Mahdi al-Mashat, as Ambassador of the Islamic Republic of Iran to Yemen. This shows the depth of the Yemeni-Iranian relations, especially with the U.S. escalating its hostile policies towards the two countries and towards the resistance axis as a whole. Erlu's predecessor left Sana'a in September 2015, and in October last year, Iran's foreign ministry said the process of sending a new ambassador was hindered by attacks on the embassy.
While some Persian Gulf Arab states' leaders rushed to normalize relations with the Zionist entity, Yemenis continued to reaffirm their support for the Palestinian cause. Abdul Latif al-Washali, Sana'a.
Vienna pays tribute to the victims of Monday's terror attack carried out by a sympathizer of the Daesh terrorist group.
It's a really tense situation, something we never had before in Vienna. So Vienna was always a really secure place and we felt really safe and protected, and suddenly, well, out of nowhere, this comes. I'm living nearby. And hearing this was really shocking.
As the nation tries to come to grips with the terrifying shooting, news has emerged of serious mishaps in the run-up to the crime.
Austria's interior minister confirmed the country did have intelligence that the gunman had travelled to Slovakia in search of ammunition in July. Apparently, a crucial tip was not followed up.
Karl Nehammer admitted to official errors.
Something obviously went wrong in our communications. An independent commission of inquiry has been set up.
In Parliament, his predecessor from the right-wing FPÖ party called for the minister's resignation. Chancellor Sebastian Kurz has called for more decisive action at the EU level against what he termed political Islam. Earlier, he'd made it clear the attack should not be seen as a conflict between Christians and Muslims. Experts believe if the correct attributions are not made, it could trigger cultural wars in society.
If you define terrorism, it's the use of force against civilians in order to create fear for political purposes. So that's terrorism. That doesn't have, this definition doesn't have much to do with religion. So it's not necessary to call it Islamic or Islamist terror.
The 20-year-old gunman, an Austrian with North Macedonian roots, had been released from prison in December. Apparently, he misled the government's so-called de-radicalization program. The main worry now is how Europe is going to deal with what experts describe as the growing threat of homegrown terrorism. Homolinski, Vienna.
Palestinian journalists in the blockaded Gaza Strip have marked the International Day to End Impunity for Crimes Against Journalists in front of the United Nations office. Journalists demanded an end to Israel's impunity and that Israeli leaders be held accountable for their crimes against Palestinian journalists. The Palestinian Journalist Syndicate handed a memorandum to UN officials demanding protection for Palestinian journalists. Since the beginning of 2019, Israeli forces carried out hundreds of attacks against Palestinian journalists.
Attacks against journalists are systematic and take place almost every day. Israeli forces target Palestinian journalists in almost every protest or event. Since last year alone, Palestinian journalists were attacked over 750 times.
According to human rights organizations, Israeli forces killed 43 journalists over the last 20 years. Additionally, hundreds of journalists were seriously injured, sustaining permanent disabilities that will probably accompany them throughout their lives.
The United Nations must come out of its silence and protect Palestinian journalists who are constantly subjected to Israeli crimes. Israeli forces have killed dozens of Palestinian journalists and injured hundreds more, while others are still in Israeli custody. We call on the United Nations to help bring Israeli criminals to justice at the International Criminal Court.
During the Great March of Return rallies, Israeli forces shot and killed two Palestinian journalists and injured hundreds while they were covering the peaceful action. Palestinian journalists say they work hard to avoid being part of the story themselves.
We are coming under deliberate and premeditated attacks by Israeli soldiers during the peaceful rallies. Israeli forces killed two of my colleagues and injured hundreds, and I was injured twice while covering the protests. Some of the journalists sustained permanent disabilities.
Experts say Israeli forces will continue with their violations against journalists as long as the international community keeps turning a blind eye.
Israeli attacks against journalists have increased in recent years. Palestinian journalists risk their lives on a daily basis to cover the news and expose the brutality of Israel. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
Deaths in custody has been and remains a serious issue of concern for many in Britain in 2020, with countless individuals continuing to die in deeply suspicious circumstances while in the custody of the police. This year, the United Friends and Family Campaign, UFFC, launched their yearly March for Justice, with this year's event taking place online due to the current COVID-19 restrictions. Despite the calls for justice continuing over many decades, police accountability and real change remain as elusive as ever, especially for black communities, which, according to the facts, are more likely to fall victim to police violence.
I think that certainly the use of force, as described by the Metropolitan Police, the extent to which they use force when arresting black people, was six times more likely. And of course, that because we're more likely to suffer mental ill health, that is always another recurring feature, overwhelming and disproportionate force, when actually what somebody needs is a caring environment, yes, restrained, but they're not criminal, they're just mentally ill. And so these are the kind of recurring factors that we see evidenced in black deaths in custody.
I'm the twin of Leon Patterson, who died in police custody in Denton in 1992, 27th of November. He was arrested on suspicion of stealing a till, which was then proved not to be the case. He was held in police custody for 6 days and was found dead in the cell on the 27th of November. The outline that I got from the chief superintendent was that Leon basically beat himself to death by throwing himself around the cell.
3 decades on from Leon Patterson's death, and like so many cases, no officer has ever been charged or brought to justice.
When we did remove the sheet from the body, I mean, it was a bit of a to-ing and fro-ing to remove the sheet, because he went, "You can't touch it." They had the morgue attendants trying to hold down the sheet, and the officer just kept standing behind me saying, "You do know this is all self-inflicted. You do know that he did this to himself." And that's when we turned him over and saw all the bruises on the back and down his legs. So to keep saying that this is all self-inflicted was mute.
Despite the calls for accountability and justice, far too many people fall victim to police violence, where far from upholding the law, they often break it with deadly consequences, knowing that they operate under a different set of laws which they themselves exist to uphold. Deaths in custody remains an issue disproportionately affecting Britain's black communities. Despite promises to enact reforms, many argue that Britain's police remains institutionally racist. Under the current government and with racism on the rise, this situation could get a lot worse. Richard Sudam, London.
In reaction to the stance of French President Emmanuel Macron in defense of the offensive caricatures of Prophet Muhammad, the Iranian daily Vatan Emruz published a cartoon of Emmanuel Macron represented as a demon, accompanied by the title, "The Devil of Paris." This cartoon came after a wave of angry protests and reactions swept across the Muslim world after the French president defended the Charlie Hebdo publication of the insulting Prophet Muhammad cartoon, declaring that France will not give up cartoons. The Macron remarks have triggered anti-French sentiments in the Muslim world, prompting calls for the boycott of French goods and an official apology.
I believe the republication of the offensive Prophet Muhammad cartoons is aimed at testing the unity of Muslims in the face of any sacrilegious act against their sanctities. The second point I think the French government is after is to make